This is Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea Reedy. Today we'll be hearing from Nina Elder, an artist, activist, researcher, and project facilitator. So Nina Elder creates projects that reveal humanity's dependence on and interruption of the natural world. With a focus on changing cultures and ecologies, Elder advocates for collaboration, fostering relationships between institutions, artists, scientists, and diverse communities. She lives in New Mexico in a house somewhere off the beaten path near Albuquerque. However, she called in from Anchorage, Alaska, where she is currently working, and she shared about her current projects and reflections on her artistic and activist work with Alice Morillon.
There's one aspect of your work and life that I'm really interested in right away, is that you're both an artist and a researcher, and both for like art institution and science institution, from what I gather. I think you work for the Nevada Museum of Art, for the Polar Lab Research in Anchorage, where you are, and also for the Art and Ecology Program at the University of New Mexico, right? So how does that work together to research both for science and art? How does art support science and science input into art?
I love thinking about that and talking about that, so I'm glad we're starting with that. I think for me, it's that both art and science are fields of inquiry and fields of experimentation. And I always point out to people that you can meet a geologist and talk to them about when they were a kid, and they started coming home with their rocks, with their pockets full of rocks, not because they were interesting, but because they were beautiful or because they were cool. So for me, there's not a huge difference between art and science, except for one is dealing in qualitative analysis and one is often dealing in quantitative analysis. And so I'm really excited to blend those two. And I think there's actually a lot of need within the science world to move beyond data illustration or, you know, these kind of old fields of like making graphs or making making data still look like data, and to start having it be something that can go into people's, you know, hearts and souls and start helping us understand the world, especially as we're existing through so much rapid change. So that's something I'm very much interested in, is human emotion and human responses in this space, right, of these much, much larger things.
Right. Yeah. So in some ways, art can be seen as a bridge almost to like convey the emotions that science sometimes is depleted of.
And also, I would say almost more of a two-way conduit as well, because I've seen science, especially with recent climate science, just be completely overwhelming and it can't keep up with itself. So if it can communicate to people, if art can communicate to people what's happening in science, but then also creativity and poetry can feed back into science about the human experience of living in a changing world. I think a lot about, it's a newly termed psychological condition that's called solastalgia, which is a nostalgia for how things are, but with a premonition that they're going to change. So it's like the solace that we take from where we are and how we are, and that we're going to feel solace, that we're going to feel nostalgic about that in the future. And so for me, that's a really interesting triangle between place and emotion and science, and that we're all kind of living in that. So climate change is definitely looms large in my work, but I also have made a lot of work about social injustices and intercultural misunderstandings and all of these places where we have maybe turned a blind eye, but there's a lot of room for reckoning and growth. I think all of those places interest me a lot.
You're right now in Alaska. What is this specific project about?
I did writing workshops with close to 100 people ended up participating over the idea of shelter and home, with this idea that what shelters us is actually changing. And I'm painting a mural at the Anchorage Museum. I'm just wrapping that up, of a list of words. So it's thousands of words describing what is shelter and what is home. And it just kind of looks like an ocean or a pattern, but then you come up to it and it's just a ton of words. And so to me, that's interesting because it's easy to take for granted what we think is essential to our daily lives. But then when you ask 100 people, you realize it's very different for all different kinds of people. So that's one project that I'm just wrapping up.
Can we see it online? Is there a place where people listening on the radio can be like, oh, I want to check that out?
Yeah, I'm very active on Instagram and my handle is Nina Elder Artist. And I'm sure there will be images on the Anchorage Museum website and on my website eventually. I probably won't be doing any web updates this week because I'm about to go on a big adventure. But yeah, there's lots of Nina Elder on the interweb. But so yeah, for quite some time, I've been collaborating with Tyler Ray and Hannah Perrine Mode, and we are all in the creative fields, but we're all very different from each other. And we're all very inspired by glaciers in different ways. Tyler is a dancer, but she also does a lot of psychological work around grief. And Hannah has a background with the science of glaciers, but she's an abstract artist and sculptor. And then there's me. And we have, in the couple years of talking, we've really realized there's just this kind of movement or a trend or a gestalt or whatever you want to call it around artists that are trying to use creative communication to talk about much bigger things, including time scales that are larger than human, earthly phenomena that seem too big to wrap your head around, all these kinds of things. So we are meeting up here in Alaska tomorrow, actually, and then we are going out to McCarthy, Alaska, which is where I've spent a great amount of time to look at some glaciers. And what's really amazing about McCarthy, Alaska, there's a huge glacial confluence, miles thick of ice, and right outside of this little tiny town. So you can literally be sitting on the patio of the bar and have a better view of a glacier than most scientists get. And the access is incredible. And through my years of being there, I've met all kinds of people. So, you know, whether we need to borrow crampons to go stomp around on the ice, or we're being hosted by the hotel. So that's really lovely. But what's really happening right now that's very exciting is there's an international team of glaciologists that are heading out into the field to set up their instrumentation for the summer. So, you know, solar paneled science rigs that include time-lapse videos and light sensors and sound sensors and all these things that are part of climate science data. But for a group of artists, it's like a scientific image is also a creative image, and a sound that's documented by something intended for science, why can it not become music or poetry? And the group of researchers we're going out with are totally open to that interpretation and play and collaboration. And I'm just so excited. And what they're specifically studying is these huge rock piles that come off the end of glaciers. The white reflective light that comes off a glacier is known as albedo. And when there starts to be more dark than light on a glacier, it starts to melt really quickly because it doesn't have that literally protective white light around it. And dark things attract heat. And so we will be out in those rubble piles setting up these instruments, which is great because my collaborative team, we call ourselves erratics, which an erratic is actually the geologic material that's transported by a glacier and then plunked down. And for us, like, that's an amazing metaphor for social movements and justice movements and time frames. Like, we get swept up in these things, but then we also get deposited somewhere and there's this impact. So we've been thinking about this conceptually for several years, but to actually be able to study that with world-class scientists is going to be very amazing.
It sounds great. Do you work with the scientists also in the artistic part? Are they involved in what you're going to create beyond like the fact that they're setting up? Are they also part of what you do once you gather all these images and sounds and ideas?
We don't know yet. So in this way, it truly is like science. It's an experiment and we have no idea what's going to happen. And it's very funny, the three of us that make up Erratics, we've actually never met each other face to face. We've done all of this work over Zoom for two years. And so we're going to meet tomorrow night here in Anchorage and head off into the wilds for 2 weeks. And I know we're
That's exciting. I love that.
It is. But we all have different access points in science. Like, I do a lot of work with astrophysicists and geologists. One of us is a glaciologist, works with glaciers. One of us is very much in the realm of psychology. So our connections to different sciences are very broad. So it's a lot of moving pieces that we'll get to figure out later.
That was Nina Elder talking with Alice Morillon. Elder is an artist who lives in New Mexico. After the break, more from her and her work questioning power dynamics with art. But first, let's listen to Jessica Pavone with a track from her album, Hope Dawson is Missing. This is TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Nina Elder's work as an artist and activist ranges from the creation of the Wheelhouse Institute, a women's climate leadership initiative, and public art projects around the United States. Alice Morillon talked with Elder about her collaboration work and what it means to drive institutions to work together. Here's Alice.
I talked with Nina through Zoom. Her bright smile, quick eyes, and positive energy came through the tiny camera and broke the distance. When we spoke, she was in Anchorage, Alaska, working on a community project with the Anchorage Museum and about to head off into the wilds to work with fellow artists and scientists on glaciers. I could see some of her art in the background, a list of words written by chalk that, like a wave of ideas, carry strength and poetry.
I think collaboration often gets celebrated kind of superficially. That word might get used superficially because it's trendy right now. And I actually don't know how good of a collaborator I am, but I am very good at coalescing a lot of different opinions and a lot of different ideas. And I think what's so important about that for me right now is I know there's a lot of privileged people that get to speak about things like climate change or land use or indigenous sovereignty or what goes in museums or what gets taught at universities. And one of my biggest goals is to really highlight that, you know, a fisherman in Alaska might know more about how the ocean is behaving than a scientist who is studying, you know, tidal floodplains. Mm-hmm. A person who gets their drinking water from a glacier is going to know a lot about how that glacier is behaving because of the silt in their drinking water that, you know, a cryospherologist might not. But I think there's a certain everyday genius to people that live close to their environments, and that goes across political divides, that goes across geographic divides. You know, I think it's often considered in the United States that ranchers and fishermen and people in certain industries are more conservative and maybe don't believe in climate change or are not part of these conversations as much. And I really want to challenge that because I think there's as much knowledge there. They just might call it something different and have their concerns framed in a different way. So it's a lofty goal. I think it's a huge issue in the United States, but I really would like to challenge that.
I love it. And how do you do that in your work? I mean, I'm assuming that just the fact that you know these 40 people that live in the tiny town, I'm sorry, I forgot the name, that means something. I'm assuming they're part of your reflection about your creation.
Well, actually, with McCarthy, Alaska, it's such a small community. And it seems so delicate to me in some ways. I've actually never made work about that. This will be my 7th summer going out there. And I've actually made work kind of about the environment. But what I have done is taken metaphors from that and then engaged with people in other places around it. And so that's one thing I'm really excited about this summer is I think bringing in those other perspectives will allow me to deal with this place, this very delicate place that I love so much. But a lot of what I do, I travel almost constantly for work, for this kind of work. And I'm often in communities where I don't belong and where I'm an outsider. And kind of my method for approaching is I usually am working with an institution and that's there for a reason, you know, whether it's an ocean or a glacier or a prairie or something. And I find the people who use that thing, who use the ocean or who use the glacier, who use the prairie, and just start talking to them about what they do. And it's not formal. I'm not like putting a microphone in their face or anything. I just, you know, hang out at the dive bar or at the grocery store.
Right.
And start to realize where those frictions and stories are, and just in a short amount of time you can learn a lot by people talking about kind of what the upheavals are that they're facing and how they're fixing them. And so that's really, I'm doing a lot of work around the concepts of like breaking and mending right now, because you can show up anywhere and people will tell you what's broken. Like you go to Indianapolis and people start talking about potholes immediately because everyone gets so mad at the potholes. But that reveals something about like the larger city's infrastructure and that they don't have a lot of maintenance and that there's these disenfranchised neighborhoods. So I don't know. I have this way of scrutinizing people's more casual conversation that kind of gets me in and gets me going with these places.
I love it. And I think it's interesting that I'm just seeing what's in your background and what you were mentioning about the wall and all those words that accumulate in your work. And it seems like to be resonating. It's like, who is here and what is being said and how can I carry that? Thank you for doing that. I think it's awesome.
Well, it's really inspired by geology. Like you go, I think we forget anywhere we are on this planet, there's layers and layers and layers of things that have been laid down and removed and sorted and shifted. And that's why I'm so inspired by geology. It's like it gives us precedent for every kind of issue we're facing as society. You can look to a rock and learn from it. And, you know, geology is violent and wild. And you know, I think it's a pretty amazing teacher if you learn how to look at it. So
I love it. I was actually going to ask you about that. If any of the work you do with the geological world informs what you see in the human world and how we deal with one another and with, you know, the natural world around us. Like, if you can draw lessons or ideas or anecdotes even from that.
Yeah, I think that's been a big shift in my work. Was for a long time, I was making these big drawings that depicted pit mines and, you know, clear-cut forests and nuclear test sites. And I've recently made a shift towards working much more poetically and metaphorically with people and with places. And a lot of that came about through this project that I did with the city of Indianapolis, where I was really looking at some of the lines that people, that divide people in that city. It's a very segregated city, both racially and economically. And it's also surrounded by all of these limestone quarries. And so I was realizing that the people who are considered impoverished are often actually the people who have the tools of like completely reshaping the earth, you know, and of building monuments and also digging the largest holes in the ground. And to me, that was just so powerful, was the thinking about like, if we take capitalism and wealth out of it, the hardest working people are the have this incredible power. And so I made a monument that's going to be installed at the new City Justice Center. That's just a huge crumbling block of limestone. And I am signing a contract with the city that there's that for 1 million years, they will not maintain that block. So it will just be allowed to return to the earth. And hopefully the jail and the justice system has totally reinvented itself within that million years. But the whole intention for me is just to realize that change comes from even within the most solid seeming things, that there's like in every block of limestone, there's so many cracks waiting to happen. And I think we can't have a justice system unless we look at the potential for change in society and individuals in what we call justice. Mm-hmm. And it's been amazing to me that the city has been accommodating of that, because to me it feels a little bit radical. but, you know, on one term, but on the other side, it's also just a big block of limestone and it really means nothing. But I love that if you imbue something as simple as a block of stone with meaning, it can take on a corrupt justice system.
Yes, I love that. Do you share any of this explanation? Do you just put that block of limestone there for everybody to look at and figure out what that might mean? Or do you give some hints of what your intention behind it is?
There's definitely hints that go with it. So I made one of these list projects with the community there about change that they needed to see. So there's this big list of words that address change. And those are actually a big bronze plaque. Like, I'm kind of playing with the idea of monuments. So there's this bronzed list of words. Uh-huh. And then it's accompanied by drawings of abandoned quarries where very important pieces of stone were quarried from. So the quarry where the United States Pentagon stone was quarried from, where the Naval Academy stone was quarried from. So these places of power, and then reflecting on the crumbling that goes alongside that. So there's a lot of pieces to that project. It's way too much to go into in 1 hour, but I'm also a writer. And so I'm writing an extended kind of series of micro essays that will be published that will kind of describe that project.
Great.
It's a many year long project. So
I want to go back to what you said just earlier about the fact that you used to draw scenes that were just like quarries and the earth being used and abused. And now you're going to something more poetic. And I'm curious what your reflection behind that shift is. Is it going from anger to hope, or from hoping to create something different in your audience and like create a different reaction then to your art and actions after that?
Yeah, that's a very good question and something that it's hard to put words to. I think as artists, sometimes we know exactly what we're doing and then putting the words to it becomes hard. For me, that change really, really started. I was doing work in Northern California, looking at fire-prone forests and communities that had been devastated by fire, and the ecology behind that, and some of the proposed solutions to that. And I had this revelation that there's so much human trauma wrapped up in those ecological problems. And I was there on the 1 year anniversary of the Paradise Fire, when so many people had died and suffered and lost so much. And it was just this really big shift that I'm not sure that I can comment on anything in a way that everyone is going to respond to in the same way, mm-hmm. you know? And it mm-hmm. was just this real, a perspective shift of, I might not be the right person to talk to Northern Californians about their fire trauma, but I'm a New Mexican, so I also have, you know, fire trauma. Mm-hmm. So how do I find these more poetic entry spaces so that each individual can maybe feel that emotional relationship that we have to our environments and how they're changing? Mm-hmm. So I think it was a lesson I learned from audience and that I hope to then transform with future audiences. But yeah, I went from drawing things that were miles and miles and miles across to things that you could hold in your hand. And it's been a really interesting transformation and a pleasurable one.
You draw, but you also take pictures. How does that work together? Is it this rock I should draw and this I should take a picture of? Is there a reason why you would pick one medium over the other one?
Well, I do not consider myself a photographer at all. But every time I publish a piece of anything, there's a lot of my photographs in there. I do a lot of public speaking. That's a huge part of my practice. And the main thing I show images of are the photographs I've taken. And so I'm kind of grappling with photography. Like, it's definitely the thing I do the most of. I think when I feel that I want to make a drawing, it's because I've found something that holds so much potency that I need to spend time learning from it. And I need to spend time either commemorating it or understanding it better, because my drawings are very meticulous and they take a very long time and they're all made out of very weird materials. So for me, like, I've never drawn a glacier, but glaciers have a lot to teach me. But I've made a lot of drawings of the pieces of rocks that get ejected by glaciers. So mm-hmm. it's like finding the right scale of teacher.
I love it. Yeah.
Thank you. I love it too. No. I love drawing.
I like the idea of spending time with something, not just taking a snapshot, which are great, but also like sinking into beyond what you see at first glance is an interesting thing.
Absolutely. Like, I started drawing. I'm untrained as a drawer. I have art degrees, but I had taken one drawing class when I was like 17. I returned to drawing 12, 15 years ago, because I had learned that I was really interested in land and how it's used. And, you know, there's a lot of classified photographs in the world. Like, there's a lot of images of mines and oil refineries and dams are actually classified. And then there's all these photographs of war and bomb testing and military sites that are all classified. And so much of that happens on our public land. And that was really starting to bother me, that you can build something huge, you can create something huge, but then you're not allowed to depict that huge thing. Mm-hmm. So I learned that while photographs could be classified, a drawing of a photograph could not be classified because it's art. And so I just became determined at that point to become a really good drawer and to be able to draw like a photograph. And so I started, the first drawings I made were of classified photographs of atomic tests and test sites. And that's just what led me down the whole path that I'm on now. And those drawings would take me 6 months, 9 months. They were incredibly meticulous drawings with very odd materials. I just remember when I would finish one, I would have learned so much and often found things in the photograph that I couldn't see as a photograph, but drawing them, I had learned. And it just felt like both meditation and relationship building.
That was Nina Elder talking with Alice Morion. When we come back, we consider the creation process off the grid in the desert of New Mexico, something Elder has experienced through 4 years in her collaborative project Plan D. Playing now, Jump to the Thunder by Jessica Pavone. That was If You Can't, a song written by Jessica Pavone. Pavone is a composer and viola player from New York City. As an instrumentalist and composer, she explores tactile experience in her compositions and performances. Her album, Hope Dawson is Missing, explores themes of transformation, deceit, and undeniable truths. You're listening to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Our guest today is Nina Elder. She is an artist whose work addresses social justice and climate change in a variety of ways. She tells us about Plan D, a title that stands for Practice Liberating Art Through Necessary Dislocation. From 2009 to 2013, she lived off-grid with other creators, exploring a reclaimed and reframed land-based notion of the American dream. Here's Alice Morion talking with Nina Elder.
And I'm curious about the idea behind that project, you know, deciding to go off-grid and far away from mundane life. I feel like there's probably a lot in that intention, and I would love to hear why.
Well, it was a collaboration with my sister, Erin Elder, and Nancy Zastadil, who now lives in New Mexico still. I was freshly out of grad school, and I had studied critical economic theory at an art school in San Francisco, and was on a road trip through Taos, and in a wild turn of events, as this happens around Taos, ended up owning an acre of land for basically nothing out by Three Peaks over the course of 5 years, building an entirely off the grid art experiment with Erin and Nancy. We used no electricity, so we didn't even have solar panels. We built everything by hand, and we were trying to exist sort of outside of capitalism. So everything we used was trash or scavenged. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my whole life, especially because it went on.
That. It sounds great, but then it sounds so hard.
Yes, it was. And it feels so long ago, you know, 10 years ago now. But and I've been in New Mexico since I was 18. So New Mexico wasn't new to me, but this idea of, you know, what do artists create when there's no studio, when there's no audience, and when there's just life to consider? And it, in some ways, it kind of felt like a survivalist camp, because there was nothing there. But on the other hand, it was so creative to actually take that fabric of life and see what people make out of it or how people respond. So it was really interesting. And I would say very successful. I think we worked with over 30 international artists out there. So people would apply to come and spend time out there. And we had a trailer eventually and a half built house that people could, you know, supplement and work on. And it was kind of before this whole off the grid thing became trendy in the art world. So it was, you know, people were taking note of how strange it was for three people to sort of drop out of the art world, which is already amorphous, and then do this thing that totally didn't even seem like art. But I will say it had a huge impact on me. And I recently just relocated my own life personally to be entirely off the grid when I'm in New Mexico. And I'm living, I'm living in a place, or when I'm there, my home is a place where I cannot see any human infrastructure. I can't see any lights or highways or power lines. And it's just been the best. And I keep thinking, wow, like I'm sort of doing what I did 10 years ago, but I'm doing it by myself now, but I'm also doing it with kind of a sense of lifetime of intention rather than as an art project.
Yeah. And is there some element of the nostalgia? Is that the word you were using earlier in moving away to like a place that's beautiful and extreme in New Mexico? Is there a sense of like, this is here now, let's enjoy it now while it's around?
Yeah, there definitely is. Like, I was there a few weeks ago when the spring monsoons were blowing through, and I was thinking how many times in my life I had, you know, taken note of a huge thunderstorm but not sat and watched the whole thing from beginning to end. And now I'm really trying to make this difference in my life, that when I'm out on the road working, I'm working, and I'm working really hard. But when I'm at this place, in my studio, I can just bear witness and be much closer to an actual place. Like, I think I had seen myself do this, where I had been calling myself an environmentalist or calling myself someone that's, you know, advocating for nature, but I would spend huge chunks of my time not tuned into nature. So there's a sense of definite relationship building that I'm excited about. And like a good example of that solastalgia is there's a lot of two-needle pinon pine on my land, and a lot of scientists are predicting that that species will go extinct in my lifetime, which is so sad because it's the state tree of New Mexico. It's so important to ecosystems, and the combination of drought and pine beetle could possibly decimate it or bring it down to a tiny percentage of what it is. Mm-hmm. And so when I bought this piece of land, at first I thought, oh, I don't want to live somewhere where there's so much two-needle pinon because it's going to be so sad. But then I thought, what a gift to be able to spend the last part of this species' life with it. Like, mm-hmm. I'm 40. I imagine I'm going to be alive for 40 or 50 more years. They think that mm-hmm. the pinon pine will go extinct in about 50 years. And so, like, what does that mean for me to join my life that's full of vitality and creativity with a species as it goes extinct? And it feels kind of like maybe I'll do some kind of like hospice work, you know, like bring some comfort or some celebration to that end. And I know that sounds really like weird for a tree, but it's, you know, it's dignified.
Yeah. Is that a sure thing? Like, is there anything we can do for pinons?
Well, I mean, I think the areas that have had low intensity fires and mm-hmm. controlled burning, there's more likelihood of the pinon surviving. But we're kind of, you know, at the end of many, many cycles of drought and beetle. And so it's looking pretty grim. But I think there are areas that have had fires, you know, west of Taos, parts of the lower Pecos that have had some fires where there might be pockets where they survive. And then, you know, there will be adaptations in the future.
Yeah.
It's so sad, though. I mean, it's just like,
I didn't know about that. And that's,
it's very hard to think about.
Yeah. But it's, I feel like that's one of those elements that suddenly bring home the reality of it. We're talking about pinons disappearing. That's what this climate change is about. It's not about just everything getting hotter and droughts. It's like this not living anymore. And I think it's important to hear.
Yeah. I just was producing a podcast, and one of the people I interviewed kept talking about bringing elegance to extinction. And to me, that was really hard to wrap my mind around. But mm-hmm. I think there's something to it that I'm really interested in that has, and that's kind of like one of the answers to why art, why poetry is, there's space for grief and beauty mm-hmm. and elegance all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it can help maybe make things more bearable and remembered in a different way too. I'm thinking of butchering animals yourself, and you know, it's a thing in Taos, lots of people do, and I've been learning about that, and it's like so hard, so difficult, but then again, then you realize that what you're eating was alive, and it's not like just in plastic in the store, right?
And or building this element of building a house out of adobe and realizing like the earth can turn into a structure and that will turn back into the earth again. There's so much I love in New Mexico that's a little bit closer to those cycles than the other places I live.
How did you get to New Mexico? You mentioned you got here when you were 18?
18.
It's
a bit of a funny story. I had basically failed out of high school, and high school just did not agree with me very well. And the University of New Mexico had the lowest enrollment standards of any college in the United States. And I really wanted to go to college. So I applied and I got in. And I thought I was just going to go for a year just to get some college mm-hmm. credit and then apply somewhere else. And it's that was 22 years ago, and it has been my permanent home ever since. So, but I have family connections. My uncle's family was an old cowboying family that were running cows kind of in the most crazy places, like over the Santa Barbara Divide south of Taos and into the Pecos. So it's like crazy to think about cows in that environment. But yeah, so I feel like that's sort of the end of a land use legacy that my family's connected to. That's pretty interesting.
That was Nina Elder sharing her creative work and her relationship to unique yet changing New Mexico. Elder is based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Find out more about her work at ninaelder.com. Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour is supported by this station, KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetaosradio.com, and our local business partner, John Dunn Shops. Music on today's show is from Jessica Pavone's album, Hope Dawson is Missing. Thanks for listening. Be well. Fire and love.